being the CEO or founder or whatever executive or any career where you're sort of high performing and successful, it's a trap because it hooks you into thinking that this is you. It's not you. You're not who you think you are, right? You're not even your ego. You're not your thoughts. You're none of that. And the closer you can get to your actual core being, the more you can take that into your work and into all these roles that you have, the better you can fulfill these roles. So it's a beautiful process.
Hi, I am Sophie Vaux, and this is the Rise and Play podcast. In the show, I sit down with influential thought leaders in the gaming industry to deconstruct how they create the best teams and company cultures in order to create the best games. Speaking to hundreds of game executives in the show, I have identified recurring patterns and mistakes that we all make in our leadership journey. Do you have to go through the same hurdles and make the same mistakes to learn too? You are not alone in this journey, and hopefully you can learn from a diverse range of seasoned leaders who already walk the talk. Every episode brings actionable insights and case studies that will help you improve your management skills, self-awareness, and empathic communication. Becoming a better leader starts with becoming a better human. Are you ready to unlock your full potential in life and business? Let's begin. All right, welcome everyone to a new episode of Rise and Play. And today I'm super pleased to be sitting with Dirk De Guus. I'm trying to say it properly in Dutch.
Yeah, you got it.
And before we get into the conversation of, well, the studio that you've co-founded 20 years ago, so you're the co-CEO and co-founder of Paladin Studio, based in The Hague. And with almost two decades as an independent entrepreneur running the game studio, you have deep practical knowledge of games, leadership, and management, and combining creativity, spirituality, and personal development with the goal of living a good life. I really like as well that holistic view of, you know, a company, really like the holistic component. And for the context of what Paladin Studio is doing, it creates games that make you smile, be it a sweet twinkle, love, or evergreen. And the studio was founded in 2005, so almost 20 years ago. And we have a team of 50 aiming to create wholesale games that have a positive impact on people. And among the partners you've worked with, also Nintendo, Apple Arcade, Lego, and Bandai Namco, which are big publishers and platforms. So we will get maybe into it in the development and noteworthy title that you've developed from the studio. Good job. Sunbound, Tamagotchi Forever, at least that I know of by the franchise. Cut the Rope Remastered and Cut the Rope Free, and live operation for existing title. And at the moment, several new games in development. So quite a lot going on, but yeah. That's what you would expect for a company that have been around for 20 years, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So welcome, Dirk. And we've met really connecting on leadership. I mean, that's how I meet most of my guests at PGC Helsinki. It was very nice. And talking about the journey of actually your studio, when I was just really impressed to hear a studio being around like for 20 years, because those days, as you know, among the layoff, there are studio, many studios that started 4 years ago and then have closed. And so for me, when you manage and lead a company to live through different times, pivot, I'm pretty sure, iterate, evolve, that's also a very hard part of the job. And that's what I was interested in hearing today. Before we start off how you started, maybe a quick also background of what were you doing before you decided, I don't know, out of nowhere, creating a company in 2005. What made you create a company?
It's total madness. No, I was freelancing and I studied animation and I was a freelance programmer. And then together with a good friend of mine, those projects got bigger and bigger. And at some point we were basically thinking to ourselves, we should probably create a cool development studio and then do bigger projects and do awesome projects. And that's what we did. So I dropped out of art school.
How old were you at that time?
I think it was 21 or 22, something like that.
Quite young. So maybe it's an opportunity to travel back 20 years ago. Nobody is doing the math of how old you are now. You know, because these days there's a lot of also learning best practices on how to start a company, It helps you have experience, thinking of who you're doing it with, thinking of a long-term vision, why are you building a company, you know, all those questions.
Yeah.
Beyond the fact that you wanted to create a studio with your friend, your partner, was there any other thoughts that were there at the time when you just jumped in and started your studio?
Well, it really was like, oh, let's build a cool studio. And I had this vision in my head, at least, that was like, oh, 30 people and we're going to be millionaires and it's going to be great. And this is the most important one. It's going to be a good environment for creative people. Together with my co-founder, Dylan, we were basically programmers at another studio. And our experiences with management at the time were not really great. So we felt a little bit left to our own devices in the bad way. And we figured, okay, if we create an environment with good management where creative people can thrive, then they will do their best work. And if they do their best work, then they're going to build great games or other products. And that's how we're going to win.
So when you started, I guess, with no network, but at least a good intention, a good partner, yeah. It's always also the question when you start, the game is the most tangible product that a studio can create that also translate the culture.
Yeah.
But yeah, with the intention of creating that great environment, how did you start to build the team, your first game, on the first years after you started?
Our start was a little bit different than most game studios, especially these days, because the game industry was really different. It was a walled garden at the time. It was really hard to break into it. Mm. You had the big publishers and they were the gatekeepers and the projects were very big. And I didn't know of any way to break in. I was going to Gamescom without any meetings pre-scheduled. And I was looking at all these white walls with big logos on it. And I was like, oh, okay, I don't know, but it's really cool. So let's go again next year. But it took me a couple of years to figure that one out. And we were also basically using game technology for non-games. So we were doing interactive visualizations or training simulators and things like that. So really started as a technical outsourcing provider, doing service contracts, subcontracting for bigger companies using game technology. And then at some point we started becoming the primary contractor, but also for non-games. So we would work with municipalities and cities for 3D environments and virtual reality type things. It's funny because it's, you know, all of the talk of metaverse and virtual reality is sort of, is a, for me, it's a throwback to 20 years ago when we got started with that stuff. And it was only until the advent of Steam and later the App Store that we really started to go into real entertainment games. And that was also when my co-founder left. And I sort of had the, I guess you can say the freedom or the a little bit more focus to just pursue my own path, if you will, and take some more risk. And that's when I really started to pursue entertainment games. And there was no single game that shaped us. However, if there is one game that sort of made us who we are, then I would say that's Momonga Pinball Adventures. It's an old mobile game where you play as a flying squirrel in a pinball environment. And it was our own self-funded project. And this was right in the beginning of the app stores. And when we started that game, you still had like the $1 downloads. That was like the norm for the business side. 2 years later, because we were working on this game on the side, because we had our regular projects that paid the bills. And then, you know, in our spare time, we would work on this pinball game. 2 years later, we launched it. And then, of course, free-to-play was big. So there was no market left for the $1 downloads. Mm. So it didn't pay off financially, but it opened a lot of doors for us and taught us a lot about the dynamics of at least mobile gaming.
Mm. And I would understand that it was a game that maybe started to generate more predictably revenues for you to pay the team and at least plan for the future. Is that so?
No, it wasn't the case at all, actually. We lost a lot of money on it.
Okay.
So what we realized by doing that is that, oh, well, self-publishing games is really hard. So maybe we should work with publishers. And I got in touch with DNA in Japan and they saw Momonga and they were like, hey, this is really awesome quality and we'd love to work with you. So we did a couple of projects with them and that's how we got into mobile free-to-play. And yeah, since then we started working more and more with publishers. So it's more of a co-development type setup.
Okay. We get back to that second chapter in a moment. I see a first chapter where you started with your co-founder and it's the genesis. How long was that where you were focusing more, like you said, on our technologies, providing type of services? And for me, in the story of co-founders, it's more your personal story. You know, you start something with someone. And what was the transition point for you where your co-founder who started it with you left and you decided to stay and go on a slightly different trajectory, like you were the only one in the driver's seat.
Yeah, so we struggled a lot in the early days and we had our good moments, but we also grew a little bit. And it's a service company and a service business. We had a lot of architectural clients and then 2008 hit us. So we were really on a pretty big roller coaster. And my co-founder, when things got really rough, it came to a point where we needed to make a decision. Do we basically scale down to the two of us and just continue as freelancers, basically? Or do we keep some of the team and continue as a studio and give it another shot? And at that point, he felt more attracted to, I call it the lone cowboy approach, where you're basically freelancing or maybe there's two of you and you're just very small and nimble. Mm. And I was more of a pirate captain that wanted a studio, right? I had that bug in my head with 30 people studio and, you know, doing cool projects. Mm. That's a very clear fork in the road that you need to make a decision on. And he was very clear about that. He didn't want to pursue the big responsibilities and the pressures of running a studio. And I was naive enough to actually do it.
And so at the time when the transition happened, so you were then the main founder, shareholder, at least from that time. And so were you the CEO then officially as well of the company?
Yeah.
Okay. And so in the second phase where you get into like real games development, what was the journey for you? How long did that journey go? Like I call it the second chapter, like the solo chapter. And even your role as the CEO, because in our private conversation, I understood that you took different roles, realizing some roles maybe were not what you wanted, but then you had to. So if you could share also that phase.
Yeah. So I think that phase lasted about 7 years, maybe 8 years. Mm-hmm. In that time, I was the CEO of the studio and we started working with mobile free-to-play publishers. And in this time, the team grew from maybe 8 people to about, let's say, 35, something like that. And I took up the responsibility of running the studio, basically. In hindsight, this has also been a mistake for me because I should have had a really strong COO next to me that's really organizationally strong and you know, taking care of all of the day-to-day and all of that. I didn't have that. I had a great guy, but not for a COO role. And I think that was one of the mistakes in hindsight. And I don't recall the year exactly, but after a while, I worked myself almost close to a burnout. A friend of mine said, well, actually, you were burnt out. You know, it's like, as an entrepreneur, when you think you're almost burnt out, actually, you're burnt out. You know, this is like, she says, it's like, yeah, entrepreneurs think that burnout is a luxury for employees. That's how we roll, I guess. But I realized, like, I can't keep going like this. So I really needed to make a dramatic change at that point in my life. And I needed to make it fast because I felt like I had high blood pressure. I could feel, you know, I wasn't healthy anymore. Just the constant stress of running the studio alone. Keep in mind, right, we don't have investors. I don't have a board or advisors. There's no fellow shareholders to share the burden with. It's also something I wouldn't recommend. It's not a good thing. In hindsight, it probably slowed me down a little bit. But said, okay, I'm going to have to take a step back and I'm going to hire a CEO and become executive chairman. And I had somebody in mind already and he took up the role. And he did that for about 3 years, if I'm not mistaken. I might get the dates a little bit mixed up, but something like that. Mm-hmm. And after that, he basically said, okay, this is enough. So we're now in this phase, like the third phase, the third 7 years, I guess you can say, like if it's a 7 year cycle where I'm trying to figure out like, how can I give myself the right role that is currently co-CEO together with Stein. And this is a new initiative that I started like probably 2 years ago. Stein has been with us for 10 years and he's now, you know, his internal hire. So yeah, we know that it's a perfect cultural fit. He's been through a lot of the company's ups and downs. So there's a lot that he has in terms of experience there. And with a bit of luck in the future, we might take more steps.
Mm. Good to remind that you are a completely bootstrapped company.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's the charm of being bootstrapped, you know, like you, you know, manage everything you want. You don't have to report to anybody, but you're presenting it in a way as well that it always has a cost, right? Especially where you're the main shareholder. Like it seems that it has been a lot on you, you have other problems that you deal with. So maybe so it's for the dream of bootstrapping, because it's a good thing to bootstrap, especially like more in the mindset when you start your business and don't want to rely on money. But as you grow and as you scale, you think maybe more collectively to not have...
It has a cost.
On one person to carry it all.
Well, that's one part, but also business-wise, it has a cost, right? Because you can't grow as fast. And yes. Also the co-development deals that we have basically are very expensive, because essentially when you work with a publisher, they take a big revenue cut, and fairly so, right? Don't get me wrong. I'm very grateful because they're also putting in a lot of money to get the game done. But yeah, for us, that means that even if we have hit games, I mean, we created like 5, 6, 7 good games that are profitable. I wouldn't call them like breakout hits or anything, but really high quality games that are profitable. The majority of those revenues doesn't end up in your own pocket, and it slows you down in terms of like getting that flywheel going of recurring revenues and things like that. So there is a real business cost, and absolutely the sort of weight or responsibilities. That's not necessarily a function of bootstrapping, but more of the fact that I didn't have a lot of co-founders that I could basically build a sort of co-founding team, you know. So it's a slightly different problem. You can also have that if you have an investor, although there's shareholders then, but having a bunch of co-founders together to share the load with, I think is probably a better approach.
And through that journey, like as you went through several phases, like 3 and of a period of 6 to 7 years, you've held mostly the role of a CEO or whatever role was needed to keep the company afloat. And maybe here a point of reflection on the CEO role, because sometimes I even have a question like, what is the CEO doing? And then I see a CEO like working on the game directly, or a CEO doing completely the marketing. So I've seen a bit of everything. But here in your context, what has been the role of CEO at different phase from your experience? And when you think about it, like how has it been for you?
Yeah. So as a service business, a lot of it is business development. So talking to potential clients, going out there, showing my face, and yeah, just getting the deals, right? Because that's our bread and butter. We're not relying on investor money, but we're relying on cash flow. It's almost like continuous deal making. Whereas if you work with investors, you have round A, B, C, you know, that's once every year, maybe 2 years, every 3 years. Yeah, here it's like multiple times a year, you need to have smaller deals in place. And of course, it's lower stakes, but it's still a lot of work to get these things done. So that's a big part of it. The other part of it, because remember at the beginning, I said, okay, I want to create a game studio where creative people thrive. And as a creative myself, I know that if you have sort of upper management, quote unquote, interfering with your, how do you say, the creative process, you know, you have the seagull art director or something, or the CEO, just seagulls like swooping by and loading a dump of shit on your head, and then they're gone again, right? Of course, that's a very negative way of putting it, but we really wanted to have autonomous teams. That means that the teams have the authority and the autonomy for creative decision making, and there's very little interference from me as the CEO as to how the game looks. So from the get-go, we sort of created a clear line in the sand. Like there's the business side, everything organizational, everything commercial. That's part of the sort of the management team portfolio, if you will. And then there's the creative side. And that actually includes account management and talking to the publishers and platforms. And that's handled by autonomous teams. So the game director, producer, they talk to the clients, they talk to publishers, they make the decisions together with the stakeholders on which direction the game is taken into. And for our own IP, it's a fairly hands-off process as well, although I'm a little bit more involved because in that sense, I'm also the, sort of the investor or the client for that project. As a creative person, I'm a little bit sad that I sort of painted myself in a corner or sort of sitting on the wrong side of the table every now and then. You know, that's another one that I don't necessarily recommend if you're a creative person. So if you're a creative person, it's something to keep an eye out for. Like, what is your role? You don't want to take away from the creative. If you have a certain mandate or say in it, you should also bear some responsibility for it. So I think that's important. So probably it's better if you are part of the team, the creative team in that case, and really are embedded in the development. But it's an interesting dilemma. And every company is different. You have plenty of companies that operate more on a functional hierarchy, and then the creative director is obviously a beautiful position for a co-founder. Yeah, in our case, that won't really work. We just don't have that. So then I would have to be embedded in one of the game teams, which is also not ideal, because then I'm just going to, you know, be gone from the rest of the company. The company needs me as well. So,
yeah. And here you touch on, I think, a very hard dilemma I found for even the new studio starting today is usually you would see people with a creative profile or experience with a dream of building the game, the team, you know, of a fun part of it, being part of a team and development. And the reality of what the business demands, what you describe, like bread and butter, what makes the company stay afloat, right? In that case, if you need to go to conferences and talk to everyone to make yourself known, that's the responsibility once again. But giving it back to you, I could imagine that it must have been hard from your creative drive to not be able to express it. And maybe if you could share it, like how were you coping with that throughout that whole journey, right? A sense of a strong sense of responsibility with the role of CEO, and you've done it. But then the cost, you know, on the personal and like your, you know, your soul was calling for, how have you managed it for so long? And maybe some tip or advice for others who may find themselves in the situation, and maybe there are other avenues to feed the creative, you know, demand.
Yeah. So in the beginning, it was easy because I was just hands-on working with the team on the projects, you know, even making the music for Momonga Pinball Adventures or some of our other games, right? So very hands-on. And over time, as we grew, I got less and less hands-on. And there was this sort of in-between period, I would say between 10 and 30 people, where I spent a lot of that creative energy on building the company, creating the organizational design and all of that. Now, the pitfall with that is that I got a little too creative, you know, trying these flat structures and holacracy and all of these fancy new ways of like shaping organizations. In the end, I realized, oh man, I actually need to work on my leadership skills and not hide behind modern management books that sort of say like, oh no, the old way is very bad and hierarchy is bad and all of that stuff. It took me a couple of years to figure that one out, but at least I could feel creative that way. And there's a lot of creativity in entrepreneurship in general. And also on the business development side, you know, coming up with good pitches and all of that, I was very involved in that in the early days and also in that second stage. But as we grew bigger, it got more and more problematic, I would say. And I was just not happy. And I think this was a big part of my sort of burnout situation. And I thought to myself, like, yeah, this is the sacrifice I need to make. I need to take this responsibility. I need to do it in a certain way because the CEO role is done in a certain way. But these are all preconceived notions of like, oh, the CEO should do this or should do that. What I didn't realize is that, well, first of all, I don't have to do it all alone. Hiring people that are very strong organizationally, very strong business-wise, that would have really taken a lot off of my plate so that I could sort of be more free to think creatively, work creatively, you know, focus on strategy and vision and things like that. And the other part is basically what I needed to do was actually find some creative hobbies. It sounds so stupid and so simple, but as a creative person, you need to create, you know, there's no way around it. And whether that's part of your job or whether it's part of just your hobby and your spare time, there's a psychologist that basically said that if you're a creative person, you need to create. And if you don't, then you will actually die little by little. Mm. Your soul or your essence of your being will die a little by little. And this is really a very important realization. It's not easy, but yeah, if you can't put it in your work, then it's fine. That's a sacrifice you can make. And I did it and it's okay. But at least I needed to find a new hobby. I found that in music and guitar and all of that stuff. So I write songs now and everything. So that's my new hobby.
What you just shared, I think it's the dilemma, really, the challenge of most people with experience in game that, you know, once have the ambition to create something bigger and then just inevitable responsibilities. And what I take away is indeed, if you are the creative person, and it was also one of the key learnings from the book from Kim Nordstrom, Up, Down, Up, different phases and scale, and the what he calls the magical pair, whether it's in the same person, which is really hard to have, or in two people, the marriage of creative and business. Yeah, this is where they can't live without each other for a successful scaling company. Otherwise, it has a cost on the individual. And I find it common, even my coaching discussion, that dilemma.
Yeah.
And it's a realization that comes after you get the responsibility, right? So you're already responsible. And then you realize it's like,
it's a
what
trap.
Now? So yeah, don't become a CEO. But no, but the thing is finding your pair, your partner, that will be complementary on the business side. Because I do like a lot of the business part, but and I find a way to be creative in business. So we all have a desire for creativity in what we do, but we channel it in different ways. And so finding that pair where you can be creative on the game, and then somebody who enjoys to be creative with, you know, finding solutions around the business or operation and execution of it.
It's like left brain, right brain, you know, what's more developed. And, you know, the right brain, I think it's the right brain, is more creative, focused, you know, that's like the artist in you. We all have both. Left side is more language and process and all of that stuff. So it's linear processing versus holistic processing. You know, it's like the CPU and the GPU.
Yeah.
It's just different ways of thinking and creating or working. And I think, yes, everybody has both sides, but if you have an affinity for more of that holistic, creative, visionary type of work, then yeah, definitely you need to give it a place. It's very important.
Yeah.
This is also why I'm now co-CEO, because it just gives me a little bit more freedom to pursue things that I find interesting. So there's creative business, that's one axis, but then there's also like operational and strategic.
Mm.
So in the trenches work versus the helicopter view. Mm. And there is, in those four quadrants, you will have your home in one of those, right?
Mm.
And it's very hard to switch between operational and strategic views. If you ask a programmer who's just doing programming all day, come, we're going to talk about strategy. They need a lot of switching time to get out of their cave, I guess, or their cave of creativity. It's not Plato's cave, it's the cave of creativity. And vice versa, for me as the CEO, it's really hard because I'm focused on the big picture stuff most of the time. It's really difficult if I need to do administrative work or some very specific document reading, or I need to set aside 2 hours or 1 hour even to do a review of a document or something like that. Actually, it's like management production time, right? It's a big difference. Yeah, it's not easy. And you need to find your sweet spot. And your sweet spot is maybe not the same for the whole duration of the week, right? Maybe you need a certain balance. You need to switch. Every person is unique in that respect. And every company is unique.
And yet you did make the hard transition, like taking a step back, admitting to yourself, okay, this is maybe, I'm not happy here, I'm not feeling well, this is maybe not the right setup for me. And then executing a change to groom, you know, a successor or somebody who can, you know, take fully the role from inside. So it's a whole journey. And I'm curious about the process of how you got there, because another part of the challenge is getting the awareness and admitting this to yourself. And because what's blocking you to see this, it's fear. Like, okay, if that's true, what I'm seeing, what does that mean for me, for my life, for the company, and so on. So emotionally, psychologically, what are the resources you've used as you could see that point, like from burnout to change to where you are today, that helped you and that maybe other CEOs and founders could, you know, think of in those moments of doubts and solitude?
I would say that retreats are actually a big part of that. The decision that I made to hire a CEO was made after I got back from a retreat in Japan. And I was feeling all zen and just really relaxed and just much closer to myself. So all of the layers of who you are, your not your identity, but your sort of persona that you project to the outside world, but also that you sort of believe in, they got stripped away during that retreat.
Mm-hmm.
So I got back to zero, which would basically meant that, like, okay, I'm happy. I know who I am. I'm a little bit more relaxed and there's a bit of space to reflect. And then I got back at work and I was sort of slammed into that CEO role again, and everything was on fire and everything was going to shit. And that was basically for me the moment I realized, like, what am I doing? You know, why do I keep going like this? I'm probably not even the right guy to fix all of these problems. I don't get the energy from it. I'm not trained for it. I'm just an art school dropout in a way. And I realized like, oh, maybe this is not the right role for me. You know, and we were at that point, we were 35 and we were growing. So for me, that was a big deal, that taking that step back. It's like if you make a painting, you know, if your nose is right in front of the painting, mm-hmm. you don't see the forest for the trees anymore. So you need to take that step back every now and then. And retreats is basically how I managed to do that.
Yeah. And I can double down on that as well, coming back just from a retreat where I was also in Colombia. And what you shared, at least getting back to your core, your truth, I think this is where you just can't avoid it and be honest with yourself and others, right? Because again, I was really deep in the topic of leadership. The best favor you can do to yourself and others is to be fine, like at the core, you know, who you're meant to be, whatever it is. Because leader, it doesn't mean that you have to be the CEO, but this is where you get your energy from, that you can have energy to create a vision, go somewhere with a group, and it comes from the inside. And it's an extreme experience, actually, a retreat and any kind of retreat where you're isolated, you're not in your normal environment. You start to question your, not reality, but your everyday reality. And then you start to see the real, like basically your own core reality when it's not distracted with all the things around, like, you know, ego or wanting to be someone or, and then, yeah, coming back with that. So for listeners as well, whether you're interested in where Dirk has been to retreats or myself, you can contact us. Definitely mm-hmm. something I can highly recommend. Another kind of retreat is also leadership retreat, where you connect with other founders. I haven't found any of that in games, but it's an idea that I would like to develop, knowing the benefits of just a retreat individually, right?
Yeah, so I think that's really good, because if you are with game people, it's very nice to just have like similar experiences. You get that a little bit with conferences, you know, but there's a lot of drinking involved and everybody's doing all these business meetings all the time.
Yeah.
Actually, what I do with a small group of friends every year pre-GDC, we just take a couple of days, we rent a cabin in the woods and we go hiking and we just chill. And, you know, it's just a really nice experience to just prepare for the week. I highly recommend that. Find some peers, find some good people that you can talk with, and that's really good. So I've also been part of groups and sort of programs that are tailored to leadership, not specifically for games. It's very useful because a lot of leaders deal with similar problems. Mm-hmm. So that's worthwhile. It's usually a little bit more expensive because they know their target audience, which is also fine, but just keep that in mind. However, I've also found actually a lot of value in just doing retreats that are not at all about leadership or whatever. You're with a group of quote-unquote normal people, it helps, because that way you're also relating to them as human beings. And it's absolutely not about games. Nobody cares about, the latest game they played maybe, but that's it. It's not about business or leadership or management or whatever. And I think the beauty of that is whenever you introduce business to a conversation, let's put it that way, there is a money component involved, and that means that there is this hierarchy component involved. And it's very difficult in a business relation to have a horizontal relationship. But if you take that all of that out of the equation, and you can do that in a retreat, right? Even with leaders in games, it's no problem.
Yes.
But all I'm saying is you don't need that crowd to actually start building insights very fast, because in the end, we're all human, right? We are all dealing with, my wife doesn't understand me, or my children and I are not well connected, or, you know, whatever it is. There's a whole bunch of these very human topics that we need to deal with as humans and not as leaders. That's really the power of going outside of game industry, outside of your normal life circumstance, and just be with a group in the forest or whatever, reflecting.
A good point as well, indeed, in not staying in your bubble, because that's also where you fall in your own bias and patterns, losing touch, you know, with humans in general. It's not just one experience, right? A retreat is like multiple setup that you can go to take a distance and spend time in a different environment. But like I said, it could be also with a different community. it brings back humility, you know. It's like you remember you're just nobody except another human being. Yeah. No title, no power dynamic in that.
Exactly. Story. That's what I love. I love that. Any situation that has that, I think, is very valuable for me personally, because we get caught up. It's a hook, right? It's a trap. Like I said, it's being the CEO or founder or whatever, executive or any career where you're sort of high performing and successful, it's a trap because it hooks you into thinking that this is you. It's not you. You're not who you think you are, right? You're not even your ego. You're not your thoughts. You're none of that. And the closer you can get to your actual core being, the more profound and interesting it's going to be. And the more you can take that into your work and into all these roles that you have, the better you can fulfill these roles. So it's a beautiful process.
Yeah. And that's how you build also a holistic organization that is reflecting also your core, not what you want it to be by the title of a persona. And for the last part of our conversation today, quite a hard exercise, but we'll try. Over 20 years, but more looking at it from the lens of leadership, because you started not being a leader, right? And I want to remind as well, I was actually giving a workshop recently of explaining what a leader is, not something I invented, but it's from a book from the 80s from John Kotter about leading and the change and why leaders are important in a world of change. And so leaders are roles that can influence, inspire, or motivate a group towards a vision, a common vision. That's just that. No power, no, it's just influence and inspiration. So with a definition of leadership, where you didn't start with any knowledge of that, how has been your journey to be where you are today? Maybe key learnings that you can think at pivotal moments that the listener could take away as well as they're running the company.
This definition is beautiful. I think it misses one key ingredient, and that is ownership and responsibility. So one of the key books for me was Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink. I'm sure you've heard of it, and anybody listening to this, I highly recommend it. And for me, he brought home the point that as a leader, whether you're appointed or self-appointed or whatever, I think the main difference between good leaders and not so great leaders is that they feel the sense of ownership. Let's make it a healthy sense of ownership, right? It can be too much, right? But it's a burden. It's a burden of leadership that you carry around. There is a burden to knowing what you know, and there's a burden to having a solution to problems, and there's a burden and a responsibility that comes with a vision for the future. And picking up that burden, that is real leadership. And that doesn't mean that you have to be appointed as a certain executive role. None of that. It doesn't mean that you have to have specific power or whatever it is. Sure, maybe a good leader exerts a lot of influence, but I think that is only a second order effect. And the first thing that any leader needs to come to terms with is that everything you do matters. Everything you do matters. And there's going to be suffering and there's going to be sacrifice, no matter what, right? And once you start to realize that, then suddenly you start to see like, oh, wait a minute. So what do I then want for myself and for the people I love and maybe for the community I'm in and maybe for the broader world? Mm-hmm. Once you sort of awaken to that level, like a slightly higher level of thinking, then suddenly you start to see like, oh, but I have a responsibility there. The actions I take actually matter. It matters, even when nobody's watching, you know? I think that's real leadership, and that's when things start to shift in your personal life and your career and everything around you. Again, it comes down to knowing yourself. It comes down to knowing your core and working from that.
Everyone is trying to figure out what is needed, required of them as they take those responsibility roles, titles, CEO, founders, any executive roles, or even being a leader, right? And I fully agree on the responsibility. It's not even a choice. You are responsible, but either you take responsibility or you pretend not to have it. And then, yeah, it has consequences as well, right? You see a leader not taking responsibility. That's the human part. And what I hear from your answer, and I hear it's also a human journey for you, to discover, understand yourself closer to who you are, to the point to even conclude that look, actually, maybe I'm not the right guy, right? So it started from a lack of awareness even, but that it's not a problem because we are, you know, a work in progress being. We don't know what we don't know, right? So it's through the evolution. And that's good that you started with that setup, but now you know more and you start something else that you don't know, whatever, you know? So that's what I hear as well through the journey of leadership. It's a journey of self-discovery.
Yes, I think that's beautifully put. Yeah, no, absolutely. Self-discovery, leadership is a spiritual growth tool as well. It's a tool for self-development, personal development, right? Yeah, so it's a beautiful path.
Thanks, Derek. There's a lot to cover for 20 years of company, and I'm not sure we've covered everything here, far from it.
But we scratched the surface.
Yeah, that's maybe for another one then in the future.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll see you at the next retreat.
See you at the next retreat.
With new insights. Thanks a lot, Dirk. Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Rise and Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on riseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time,